Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, Laura Tremaine talks about finding her tribe and how sharing online has helped her. Plus, we'll hear about the new campus in Shannon looking to encourage mobility innovation. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. On Tuesday of this week, I did my first impressions review of the new Samsung Galaxy S21 Ultra on the Pat Kenny Show. A lot of people were in touch since then asking if the new phone is worth upgrading to. I have to say I used it for about 10 days and I was very impressed by it. I do think it is a lovely phone. The screen is quite big, so just be mindful of that. I found the same thing with the iPhone 12 Pro Max. It can be a little bit top heavy because the cameras, there are so many cameras and a lot of stuff on the back of the phone now that I found it ever so slightly top heavy and slightly uncomfortable to a certain extent when I was using it myself. I did like it. I think it is an incredibly impressive phone. If you read the spec sheet on it, it has more than you could possibly need or want. If you are someone who uses a lot of video, a lot of photographs, because the screen is so big, it's great for productivity, but also Netflix looks fantastic on it as well. That being said, I don't think I'll be ditching my S20 anytime soon. There just wasn't enough of a leap for me to go from the S20 to the S21 Ultra. I did some camera testing earlier this week, as I tend to do. I had the Google Pixel 5, which is in and around the €600 mark, the Samsung S20, which was last year's flagship, the S21 Ultra, which is the new one, and then the iPhone 12 Pro Max, which is sort of the king of iPhones. And it was really interesting to see that while there wasn't a huge amount in it, in those four phones, despite the price disparity, the image clarity on the S21 Ultra and the iPhone 12 Pro Max does make a difference. When you're looking at four images side by side by side by side, you can see just smaller things. Like, the iPhone is really great at capturing true colors. It is definitely the best, in my opinion, when it comes to low light imagery. But the 21 Ultra is fantastic. It is just, it's very intuitive, and I find that the images that I'm taking day to day show up really well. So if you are on the hunt for a new phone with the best camera on the market, I do think those two are the ones to focus on, the S21 Ultra and the iPhone 12 Pro Max. But then it comes down to whether you're an iPhone person or an Android person. I'm really hoping to get my hands on the standard S21 this week, so I will have my full thoughts on that over the coming weeks. But if you want to see the first impressions of what gadgets arrive in and sort of the unboxing process, do make sure to check out my Instagram @JessKellyNT, because that is where that initial unboxing does tend to happen. I'm very excited about this week's show. My first guest is Laura Tremaine, and she has been very active in the online space for the guts of a decade. She worked in TV and movies for many years on productions such as Jackass, which was directed by her now husband, Jeff Tremaine. And after the birth of her first child, she entered into the world of, as she calls it, mommy blogging. Since then, she's used her voice to build an online community. She hosts a podcast called 10 Things to Tell You, and her first book is just about to be published next week. It's called Share Your Stuff, I'll Go First. Laura is someone I have followed in the online space for many years now. And as you'll hear me say in this interview, we have very little in common, but I've always admired how she uses her space online to share her life, create thoughtful conversations, and give a sense of encouragement, which is very important, particularly at this very weird time.
Laura, you're very welcome to Tech Talk. You are someone that I have followed online for many, many years. And I can't remember how I first stumbled upon your blog, which was called Hollywood Housewife. But you documented so many brilliant, lovely, thoughtful moments of your life as someone who kind of came from a TV background. Before that, you were a small town girl from like Oklahoma who came to LA. And you were documenting very interesting years in your own life, a first-time mother, then becoming a mother for the second time. But you always did so with such great openness. Is that instilled in you to be that open, honest, and sometimes quite raw?
I think it is. I think it is just the way I am naturally. And so when people point it out, like they say, thank you for being so open, or how are you so open? I'm almost baffled by the question because I think I've always been this way, but I did grow up in a family that was very, very private. My parents, my siblings are very, very private people. And so I was sort of the odd man out, but they never stifled me. Like they never kept me from being open. So I just continued from childhood now onto the internet, just sharing very casually.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing. And one of the great things, and I've said it to a few people who I've spoken to about you and the community that you've built, is that no matter what you're posting about, there are some things like, I don't have kids, I'm not married, I don't live in LA, I live in Dublin. So our lives are incredibly different. But you do often pose very interesting questions that often kind of stop me in my tracks. And I sometimes will screenshot your stuff and come away thinking about it for quite some time. Do you intend to kind of go a bit deep? Like, do you want to get to the root of things? Are you doing it for the clicks? I mean, you know, where does this come from?
I am not doing it for the clicks. Although that would be a really good strategy. If I was better at thinking ahead, maybe I would be doing it for the clicks. But no, I am doing it out of genuine curiosity, and I do like to go deeper. You know, I'm not opposed to shallow stuff. I do sometimes post on shallower topics. I follow a lot of light and fluffy accounts, and they bring me a lot of joy because they're pretty or whatever. But for the most part, like in my real life conversations, I just prefer to go deeper. Like it's sort of always an itch I'm trying to scratch. But of course, you can imagine that not everyone in my life wants to go deep all the time. So that's when you turn to the internet and you're like, is anyone willing to go deep with me today?
And there often is, like you will always find your people, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. It's actually in the early days of mommy blogging, like pre-social media, it was exactly that. Like I would post a long, wordy blog post about motherhood or anxiety or marriage or living in a big city after having grown up in a teeny tiny town. And, you know, it was different because social media is so immediately reactive. People can react like within seconds. Blogging was a little bit of a slower burn, but the same thing was happening in that people were excited to see when all the mommy bloggers or when so many of us were sort of sharing our stuff, we're going a little bit deeper. People were really attracted to that because it's hard to think of now, but 10, 15 years ago, there wasn't a lot of people doing that. You know, the internet was really, that was like such a novelty to be able to just sort of share yourself openly and not face like the same kind of cultural background or the same kind of cultural backlash that you might get if you were to say something really vulnerable at like a dinner party. And then there's like an awkward pause where everyone's like, why is this person doing this? The internet was the opposite of that. You could share yourself, and then the people who didn't care wouldn't read, or you didn't see their face. The people who did care really responded in kind, and they wanted to go deeper also. And so when I started doing that on the internet, it like something clicked for me and that, oh, okay, this is how you find your people. This is how you are able to connect if you don't have that in your real life community. And by the way, all my whole thing about sharing our stuff, I'm not encouraging people to share their stuff on the internet if that's not their jam. I understand that there's like a lot of pitfalls to sharing yourself on the internet. And in many cases, it's better to share yourself in real life with people that you trust and that are safe for sharing. But for my path in this way, it was really doing it on the internet that made me understand the magic in the sharing.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're kind of reminding me of Sinead Burke, who is an activist who is from here in Ireland, but she has traveled the world. She's been on the front cover of Vogue and every magazine, encouraging people to think about design and our bodies and clothing in different ways. But she told me on her very first show that the internet was somewhere where her voice was heard, regardless of what she looked like or regardless of what she was wearing or anything like that. There was just an acceptance of this community from her blog. And you've spoken previously about how, you know, when you started your blog, you probably weren't in the most fantastic, comfortable space within your own skin. Was there a particular moment where the penny dropped that you kind of felt like I have found my tribe and I can be as open as I am comfortable with on any given day?
Yes. I mean, there were a few of those moments. I did start my blog out of a season of loneliness. Like, I was really lonely in a new marriage and in new parenthood. I'd worked in television production, film and TV for like most of my 20s. And then when we decided to start a family, I was at home suddenly. And all of my friends that I'd made in LA were still working. I didn't have any mommy friends. I was feeling very lonely. So when I started my blog, it was a little bit out of, like you said, not a great place, a little bit of a desperation. And also to just try a creative outlet, you know, that was, blogging was like a really fun thing to try. But I would say there was a moment where I realized there was sort of a tipping point where I shared myself a lot and made some friends that way, made other blogger friends that way, made some wonderful connections. And then there was sort of a moment where I realized, like, okay, I've now, after a year or two, I've now built up a real life community. I've made some real life friends, both locally and worldwide from this blog. And so I can balance a little bit better what I want to share online about our family or about my own inner life, and then what I want to keep for, you know, real life friends and what needs to be kept private. You know, I mean, there was a tipping point, but in the beginning, it was just throwing the spaghetti against the wall. You know, it was just sort of figuring out what I wanted to share, like what, where the line was for where I felt comfortable with sharing, when I crossed it, when I maybe didn't share quite enough, what people were responding to. Like, I was in the beginning of those blogging years trying a lot of different things. And that felt like so much freedom. You know, now on the internet, there's the pitchforks come out if you misstep on the internet so quickly. And there's so much judgment around, oh, this person is way oversharing, or, oh, this person is too cold and doesn't share enough, or it's very difficult to navigate these waters these days, I feel like, because of social media. But in the beginning, I was trying all kinds of different ways of sharing. But there was a time where I realized, like, okay, I've sort of figured out how I want to be on the internet, like what types of things I want to share about that doesn't compromise my family life, or, you know, doesn't betray anyone else's private life, but I can still share myself and feel good about that and feel the connection that I, you know, really like, and talk to people from all over the world. I mean, I had to find those boundaries for sure. And it took a few years, but at this point, I mean, don't totally hold me to this, but at this point, I feel like I'm in a sweet spot of it.
An interesting thing happened a few months ago, in that you sort of unveiled your children's names for the first time online. And I thought that was super interesting because, again, I think I followed you since before your son was born. So those of us in your online community kind of knew what your kids looked like. They, like, you kind of knew what their style was, but you always kind of kept their names back for your own sort of peace of mind and security, I suppose. What led to that change in decision? Because obviously kids in the online space is such a hot topic.
Such a hot topic. And when I had my first child, she was born in 2009. I started that mommy blog in 2010. At the time, the trend was to use like cutesy names for your kids, like little, you know, fake names that you made up. And that was because we were still a little bit worried about internet security, which of course is still something that every parent should think about. In terms of, I didn't want people to, maybe if they saw our children out and about, to speak to them by name, like with a familiarity, when they would be strangers to my children. That made me a little bit nervous in the beginning. That trend sort of fell off as mommy blogging changed, but I still never revealed the kids' names. We also had a different factor in our family, and that my husband is a director and producer, and he has a very large fan base for people who like his movies. And it's very different from our family life. Like, his work and everything that he makes is very, very separate. He doesn't post anything about our family life. And so I was, you know, exposing all these things over on my mommy blog. And so it felt like it was a compromise from his work and from what I was doing to keep the kids' names private. Well, I mean, my daughter's 11. Like, I managed to keep their names private for 11 years. And I wanted to write about them in my book. You know, I write quite a bit about becoming a mother in my book. And I wanted to use their real names in the book. I didn't want to use these cutesy, very sort of silly nicknames that I'd made up in 2010. That just seemed silly. And so since the book was going to be coming out and I knew I was using their real names in the book, I felt like I wanted my online community, who, like you, had been around for a really long time. They had watched my children grow up. They deserved to know their names first. Like, I sent it out in my email to my email list, people who've been around for a long time, to say, these are my children's names. I'm entrusting you with this. I don't want you to read it in the book like everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I knew that no one was going to care as much about this big reveal as I was. Like, I'm the one who had kept it a secret all this time, and I was the one who was now finally saying it. No one was going to care as much as me. Like, most people were going to be like, oh, cute names, keep scrolling, whatever, you know. But I did get some really heartfelt emails from people who had followed for a long time and, you know, felt that they had an investment in my children's lives and well-being and everything. And they were, like, very happy to know their names. So it was kind of a funny, internet moment for myself, at least. It was kind of a really big deal. But thank you for bringing it up, because, you know, not everyone else thought it was a big deal, which I understand.
I just thought it was so interesting because, as you mentioned previously, you know, it can sometimes feel like you can't do right for doing wrong on the internet. And I just thought, you know, as someone who has kind of followed the journey for quite a while, it was a sort of a big moment. And it also was a good reminder. I felt it as a good reminder that, you know, we do sort of control the taps on our own internet life. You know, just because you do something or you have someone in your life doesn't mean you have to document it. You don't have to, you know, document every second of every day. You can have an element of control. It's not as overwhelming as it sometimes can feel.
That's right. And I think that sometimes we have these unfounded fears that, like, I had a fear, you know, part of it is legitimate, but, like, we have these fears of, if I say this on the internet, if I do XYZ, that everyone is going to come after me. I already mentioned pitchforks, or everyone in my family is going to be mad. We build up these stories in our head of what's going to happen if we share or if we don't share, whatever. We sort of make these stories up in our heads, and they're not always real. Like, there's not always going to be a huge backlash if you post something a little bit vulnerable, or even if you post a controversial opinion. That doesn't mean it's going to, like, go viral and you're going to lose everything. Now, everyone should be very thoughtful about what they post. Really, really, really. Of course we should be. But I also think there's a lot of fear out there of, like, if I post this, something really bad is going to happen. And in a lot of cases, no one cares as much about what you post, except for you.
No, for sure. And it is scary. And you know what, like, I'm 31 years old and I still panic about all of these things that I thought I'd left behind when I left school. You know what I mean? They just stick with you for a long time. And I think the internet can be a great place of freedom, but also a horrific place of judgment, regardless of what you do. One thing that I'm curious about is that you are very open about talking around things like anxiety or worries. You've been brilliant at documenting your own COVID-19 experience and using your platform in that way. Does it make you nervous or apprehensive when it comes to not being like a well-being guru, but giving your take on things? And how do you draw the line and stop before you get painted as something that you're not?
Well, I try to be very candid on every podcast episode or, you know, every post that I am not any kind of an expert on this. I am not medically trained in any way. I'm not even super educated on the topic. only my own experience is what I am working off of. Not that I haven't read things or tried to research, but in general, I am not trying to educate my audience on any kind of mental health. I am just sharing what it looks like for me, because I think if you are experiencing some symptoms of, let's say, postpartum anxiety or something, and then you Google it, what comes up can be very scary or very medical jargon, or it doesn't quite fit how you feel. And so you decide not to tell your doctor because you're already dealing with a lot of fear and a lot of stuff. So for me, my whole point is to just say, this is how it feels for me. This is how my body feels. This is how my looping thoughts work. And this is when I know that this is anxiety and not intuition. Like, this is how I have figured out how to live with some mental health stuff. I've started therapy and I'm very open about that. Like, I just really try to give a lot of disclaimers because I don't want to be branded any kind of a wellness person or a mental health expert or someone that you should come to for advice. I do not give advice about it unless it's just like girlfriend type advice, like, you know, maybe you should try this or that, but not like actual advice. I just try to be very, very explicit about that. I care a lot about that. And I am often pointing my audience towards, you know, like people who do know what they're talking about from like a medical standpoint or something. And that for me, it's just my own experience, because if I had had someone that I followed who shared that same way, again, not an expert, but just said, hey, this is a symptom of anxiety for me, is that I have trouble yawning. This is one of my symptoms. I can't yawn. I like have a really a tightness of chest. And when my body goes to yawn, as one does when it's tired and I can't, I know that I'm having a lot of tightness and that I, you know, maybe need to be mindful of that. So that's just like one little example. If I say, hey, everyone, this is what it feels like for me when I'm in an anxious episode. If someone had posted that for me 15 years ago, I almost would have like wept with relief, because I dealt with all of my symptoms not knowing that it meant anything. Mm-hmm. Like, I knew that I had trouble yawning sometimes, but I didn't know what that was a sign of or not. And it was scary to me. And Google doesn't always help, you know, or the results are, you know, very, very scary.
Yeah, so, it can be awful. You can convince yourself you have anything if you go near Google. But what I have found, though, is from you, and you kind of humanize these different things, and you take it from, you know, I think if you start Googling, if you're worried about something, it can be very cold and very medical and very direct. Whereas if you say something like, you know, I can't yawn, that could be a thing of anxiety. You think, oh, well, geez, my one is I get a little rash up my neck, or you know what I mean? Everybody has their little quirks. And I think you humanize things without, you never come across as a preacher, which I think is why your audience loves you. You're just a normal person documenting bits and pieces, but it's always quite thought-provoking the way you present it, which I definitely appreciate anyway, for sure.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you saying that.
I want to talk about the book, because I know we've been talking for nearly half a day. And the new book, it's Share Your Stuff, I'll Go First, 10 Questions to Take Your Friendships to the Next Level. And I have been reading it over the last number of days. And I knew the second I finished the preface, which is beautifully written by your friend, Jenna Fisher. It's just a lovely sort of snapshot of your personality and what we can expect from the book. But I, as soon as I finished that, I went and got a little copy book, and I've been sitting with your book with a copy book, because I have a digital version, and writing out little bits and pieces from it, because there are so many nuggets that, regardless of whether you talk about this with a friend or you just ponder over it yourself, it's exactly the kind of book we need right now when we have more time on our hands to think and consider things. And I absolutely love it.
Oh, thank you. That is so kind. You know, when I wrote this book, like I turned it in over a year ago, I did not realize how timely it would be. But in the pandemic, in COVID, so many of us are feeling extra disconnected because we've had to stay at home or because the internet has gotten so divisive. And so I am hoping that the book will be like extra timely for people to reconnect with friends or sort of just with themselves in a journal, like you said, and just sort of be, you know, take a moment to be introspective about the things in their life that they sort of want to mark or remember or claim as part of their identity. I'm really hoping that the timing on this is good for people and meeting them where they are right now.
Yeah, what I love is the way it's laid out. So you have your different chapters, which could be, you know, big, overwhelming things if you just read them on their own. Like, who are you? Who was there? What are you afraid of? You think, oh, Jesus, everything. I'm afraid of everything. But then at the end of every chapter, there's almost, there are 10 takeaways, which are just so great. But the one that I found really useful was about 10 ways to journal, which I know is part of your sort of morning ritual where you focus on your reading and your journaling and you just give yourself that space in the day. Do you think that the journaling thing is something that anyone could do, or is it a specific type of personality?
Well, I think people label themselves as either journalers, they take a lot of pride in it, or they're like staunchly anti-journal. I've recently learned people are sort of against journaling. They tried it and they hate it, or they sort of judge people who do it. There's a lot of feelings around journaling. But why I put that part in the book and why I like to talk about this is because most adults get to a place where they only think journaling is one thing. Like they remembered it from their teenage years as like, dear diary, I have sad feelings or whatever, you know, and that's what they think of as journaling. And they just have like no interest in doing that dear diary type of, you know, writing. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Like there's a million ways you can journal. Maybe it's the word has like a connotation to people that they don't like, but there's so many ways that you can dump your feelings out on the paper that will be very beneficial to you. And it doesn't have to look like what you think journaling is. A journal doesn't have to live on your shelf for 10 years. I often journal and then throw it away. I just needed to get something out onto the paper, like an ugly feeling, some anger, some regret. And then I don't want that living in my house or in a pretty book. Like I need to dispose of that. That is still journaling. But making a bullet list of here are all the things I remember about this trip I just took or whatever. That is still journaling. It doesn't have to be coherent sentences. It doesn't have to be in a pretty book. It doesn't even have to be kept. But I really do believe in the power of getting what's inside of us down onto a page is a way of releasing it sometimes if you need to release some of that emotion, or it's a way of marking a really important moment. It's a way to figure out what you think. Sometimes personality types, like they're not even positive what they think about something until they write it down or until they say it out loud. But we don't always take the time to do that, right? Like we're mm-hmm. just like, oh, I'll think about that later. But if you just take 10 minutes and be like, just write. It doesn't have to be complete sentences. It doesn't have to be pretty handwriting. Just write it. And then you might come to a conclusion about how you feel about something, about a decision you want to make, anything like that. I just want to give people a lot more freedom in what mm-hmm. journaling is instead of like putting it in this box of like, you know, angsty, introspective, navel gazing. It does not have to be that.
Yeah, I have tried over the years to keep a diary, keep a journal, and the type of personality that I have, I am. I have a press in or a cupboard in my apartment that is just filled with notebooks that I like too much to write in. That's the kind of personality that I am. So that's, I think that's a different book that I need maybe to get over that one.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah, I think so. Laura, I've taken up so much of your time, but I want to just finish up by asking, you know, America has gone through such a turbulent time over the last number of years. We keep hearing the promise of, you know, brighter days are ahead. Do you think that documenting this time as you have done will stand to you, whether it is for your own, you know, well-being, mental health, but even for your kids and maybe even your grandkids someday, that it will be there archived in a beautiful, thoughtful format?
Well, I don't know how they will read it exactly, because I'm journaling, I'm documenting online, but I think it is really important to do. I do not trust that historians or journalists or essayists will be able to capture this time exactly how I experienced it. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful for the people who make it the official record. But you know, when I think about, would I rather read about the Great Depression in a book, a history book, or would I rather read it in my grandmother's letters? Well, to me, I'd much rather read what it was like for her in her Oklahoma town, in her words. Like, I would just prefer that. That would paint a different picture for me of what it felt like to live through the Great Depression, for example. So we are going through a really monumentous time, a really momentous time in American history, for sure. And I really want people to write down what it was like for them. It might be interesting our own selves to read in 10 years, let alone our children reading it back, and just think, wow, I'd forgotten that that's what it was like. I'd forgotten that that's what I thought back then, because now time has played out and I feel a little bit differently. I just think that this part is very important. And you can document this, again, if you're not a journaler, I'm encouraging people to do it in their Instagram. Like, just don't trust, oh, someone will make a documentary about this someday. Well, I mean, they will, but also for history's sake, we have all these tools at our disposal now. We have much more than just pen and paper. We should be documenting what our lives were like in this crazy moment that we're in. It's important.
Yeah, it absolutely is. In Ireland, we have just gone into a third lockdown here as a result of COVID-19. And I honestly, hand on heart, would say that reading your book over the last few days with my little copy book has kind of been a nice grounding time of reflection, and not just on the pandemic, but life as a whole. And I would highly encourage people to pick it up, get the copy book, get a highlighter, and just go to town. It is called Share Your Stuff, I'll Go First. Laura Tremaine, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here on News Talk. Thank you so much for your time.
This was so fun. Thanks for having me.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address, as ever, if you'd like to get in touch. Or you can find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. Just to flag, on Monday morning's News Talk Breakfast, I'm going to be telling Shane and Kira all about how you can smarten up your home without breaking the bank. We'll be talking about doing it retrospectively. So if you are in a home for quite some time but haven't embraced technology in the different ways, we'll talk through that. And also have some tips for those who are perhaps considering a new build as well. So do make sure you tune in to News Talk Breakfast on Monday morning from 7 a.m. We're going to chat now with the CEO of Future Mobility Campus in Ireland. This is a new venture that's being run by Russell Vickers. Russell, you're very welcome to the show. Just tell us a little bit about what exactly the Future Mobility Campus is.
Yeah, so the campus is essentially a test bed for future mobility. So that kind of is pretty wide ranging. But the idea is essentially my previous role was with Jaguar Land Rover based in Shannon. And there's a lot of disruptive forces happening in the, not just the automotive industry, but kind of across mobility as a whole. So the idea was we started to look at that from our perspective and what could we do to, you know, increase Ireland's standing in this. And it was kind of, it became clear that, you know, the idea of having a test bed where different companies could come in and, you know, test different technologies and collaborate and work together and enable startup companies, etc. That would be a really great thing to have in Ireland. And that was basically where the idea of it came from.
Yeah, this part of the country is a huge, I suppose, testbed in terms of technology. There's a lot of activity going down there, particularly in the motoring world. So what exactly does your campus facilitate, and who are the types of brands that are getting involved and going to hopefully use it?
Yeah, so we're looking at kind of all sort of facets of the disruptive forces that are happening at the moment. So in the automotive world, there's a lot of concentration around autonomous, electrification, shared mobility, and also connectivity. So all of those forces, you know, by themselves are fairly disruptive to any industry. But when you have them all happening at the one time, it's a real sea change. And that's where you're seeing a lot of disruption across the globe in terms of new car companies that are coming on stream and how we're going to use vehicles going forward, but not just cars, but also things like e-mobility. So when JLR established, Jaguar Land Rover established their software development center back in 2017 in Ireland. And I was part of the team that was there from the start of that, and kind of realized that there was a whole ecosystem around, not just on the West Coast, but also in Ireland, because essentially, if you look at it from this perspective, all automotive companies are now trying to become tech companies. So Tesla, I think, is a, is a is an example of this, where they're actually more of a tech company than an automotive company, and they're approaching from that side. And now automotive companies are looking to do the same. So they need a lot of the skills based on, you know, hardware development, software development. That's where Ireland has a lot of strengths to play with it, to play in that side. And then, you know, when you look at some of the partners that we have, and some of them are just even based in the region. And so we have Jaguar Land Rover, obviously. We have Cisco that are based in Galway, and Valeo based up in Tuam. So all of these companies are working in this space, as well as companies like Analog Devices, and there's Dell in the area as well. So there's a lot of companies in this area that are now operating in these transportation divisions, let's say. And that's where the whole network effect of what we were looking at started to come together. And then we realized that this could be a capability for not just automotive companies, but other technology companies to show off what they're doing in terms of managing smart cities of the future and things like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating because we know that there's been a lot of innovation in this space. I've been to CES for the last number of years, obviously not this year now, but in previous years. And one of the fascinating things to me is the fact that a lot of this technology is ready to go, but it's sort of society and legislation that's not ready to facilitate it. So is this going to be a test bed for more of that sort of proof of concept type of thing, so we could see how it would play out in a real life scenario?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, as you said, you know, some of these things have been kind of proved at multiple CESs over the last few years, and companies like Waymo, et cetera, have, you know, been really pushing the boundaries on this. I think there's a couple of interesting aspects from an Irish context. One is exactly that. How do we legislate for this going forward? How will we operate this with our road networks? You know, we have a really diverse set of road networks in Ireland, ranging from pretty advanced motorways down to these, you know, very small rural roads, and, you know, that essentially pose a lot of different challenges to driving around in sunny California or Arizona, for example. So that's one piece of it. So working with, you know, the likes of the Department of Transport, the Road Safety Authority, to help understand, one, from a testing point of view, like how will we actually safely test these vehicles, because obviously safety is paramount. But then how do we actually integrate these things and these systems into our road networks as we move forward? One example of that is around around the connectivity side. So this concept of vehicle to vehicle, or vehicle to X, vehicle to everything communications. And that's where you're basically allowing the vehicles to talk with the infrastructure, or talk with the vehicles around them to understand the situation. Say, let's say there's fog up in the next couple of kilometers. So the vehicles can then pass those messages back one to the other. Or even if there was a sudden braking event and the driver mightn't be paying enough attention, the vehicle, maybe 10 cars in front, can then pass that message to the other vehicles to prepare to slow down. This stuff is, as you said, is almost upon us in many cases. Some of these features are going to be basically mandated into the safety ratings of vehicles. So especially around the vehicle to everything, the vehicle to X side, that's going to be an area where, you know, you won't get your 5-star rating on your vehicle anymore unless you start having these features built in the next couple of years.
And so in terms of the campus then, you know, how big is it, and what are the facilities that are there for the different big players to come down and test out and road test and all the rest?
Yeah, so essentially we're leveraging the Shannon Free Zone. So Shannon Free Zone is owned and managed by Shannon Commercial Properties, which is Shannon Group. So that's kind of the concrete infrastructure that's already in place, let's say. And then what we want to do is basically lay the kind of IT infrastructure on top of that. So we'll be essentially building a micro smart city, which allows us to kind of push the boundaries on what we can do. Like there are other smart city projects, you know, even around Ireland. But what we want to be is a bit more on the cutting edge for those technologies. So essentially, you know, we can swap things out as we see fit. Essentially, we'll also have you know, a couple of mule vehicles, as they're called. So these vehicles are being provided by Jaguar Land Rover, who are one of our partners. And essentially, we'll be adding a lot of sensors and connectivity to those vehicles. And that then allows companies to, you know, use those vehicles as an asset to basically understand, you know, to develop new software algorithms. Or for example, let's say you were developing a new radar or something like that, and you wanted to test the performance of that on actual vehicles. Well, if you're a startup company, these vehicles cost, you know, maybe 300,000-400,000 euros per piece. So instead of having to have that, you know, big capital outlay at the start, you can use FMCI or Future Mobility Campus to actually leverage that, rent the vehicles, come down, put your sensors on that, and then that enables you to compete with, you know, with a global industry essentially. So it's, the projects have been supported by Enterprise Ireland and the Department of Business, Enterprise and Innovation. And I think, you know, the reason why they're supporting that is not just because, oh, hey, it's really cool to have a futuristic testbed on the west coast of Ireland. It's more around what will this do for Irish companies in terms of, you know, developing new products, as well as the multinationals and research agencies that we have here.
And from your own point of view and your own team's point of view, then, what services do you guys offer, or is it just we have the space, come on down?
Yeah, no, it's a bit more than that. We have, so obviously, you know, we have sort of the assets of what we're putting in, which, you know, which is infrastructure, connectivity, the vehicles, etc. But then there's a whole data collection piece around that that you can imagine is that these vehicles generate tons and tons of data, and then you need to use, you know, take all that data and validate it. So there's that whole piece of that as well. So being able to take the data, understand it, manage the data, create something useful out of that for different parties to use that. So that's a big part of what we want to do. There's also the network effect of, you know, of us just being there. So we've onboarded a lot of great partners that have really, you know, come in, and we have more companies and parties joining all the time. So there's that whole bringing that together. So we're starting to see collaboration between companies who mightn't have talked too much before, and they're starting to realize, oh, hey, you've got this interesting product. We've got this product. Let's merge the two together. And that's where there's a lot of creativity coming from that.
We've spoken a bit about cars there. What about drones? Is there a space and a home for drones on campus?
Yeah, there's a big space for drones. So, like, you know, my background was obviously coming from Jaguar Land Rover, so focused on the vehicle side of it, on the road side of it. But you know, drones is a massive piece of that. So we're extending the capabilities of the Future Mobility Campus to cover drones and UAVs, which are unmanned aerial vehicles. And you probably saw that, Jess, when you were at CES maybe last year. You know, it was all about the unmanned aerial vehicles, these essentially air taxis being developed by car companies like Hyundai and teaming up with Uber and stuff like that. That's a massive potential growth market across the globe. And we want Ireland to be a part of that. So, you know, we have a strong background and a strong aviation industry, even with COVID aside. Obviously, there's a lot of aviation companies that are based out of Ireland. We want to basically leverage all of the tech side of what we have, as well as that, to basically create a dedicated drone and UAV testing facility down in the campus as well. It's right beside Shannon Airport, so that's obviously there's things people might say all around the safety concerns, but these are things, problems that need to be solved. You know, Shannon Airport's a really great asset to, you know, interact with the Irish Aviation Authority, understand how these systems of the future are going to work out, how you manage the data, etc. Because, you know, this technology, this is coming. This is something that's going to take off. We see what, like, Bobby Healy and Manor are doing in Oran Mór with the drone deliveries, and that's just the very tip of the iceberg.
I know anyone listening to this will want to know, you know, when will all these things be on our roads and in our skies? Are you like an important stepping stone to get them from, you know, the sort of lab situation closer to being on our roads and in our skies?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's, you know, it's the certification of these systems, whether it's for road or for air, is a massive piece of that. And that's a part that we want to play in this, as well as, you know, you can do a lot in simulation, and you can do a tremendous amount in simulation for these type of systems. But there's always the last couple of percent that you really need to prove out on the road or in the air. And even just to understand, you know, how you manage the data around the systems, like how do you manage commercial air traffic with these air corridors for drones, etc., and to make sure that, the systems interact correctly together, and also that, you know, that there's absolutely no safety issues as well. So that's really where what we're building down in Shannon. That's really where this comes into play.
In terms of the types of people who can come down and use this as a test bed, does it have to be one of the big companies, or could it be someone who's you know, trying to innovate in a new way, whether it is like a smart cities application, whether it is an add-on for a car or a drone or whatever? You know, can the average innovator just go down and use the facilities?
Yeah, it's open to everyone. It's open to, we're working with the different research agencies and the universities around the region and across Ireland, and then we're also open to startups. So we've had a few startups approach us. So we're currently in the build out phase. You know, we've only kind of got going in the last couple of months, but we want to be operational by September. A big piece of what we'd like to have as part of that is an incubator where essentially, you know, we can give a leg up to these like very small operations that are just starting to get to go, and they've got a great idea and they're trying to figure that out. And that's really a key piece of what the Future Mobility Campus can offer, because, you know, there's a few million euros in capital outlay that have to go in to build all this infrastructure. Now we have that as the platform, and then it's for people then to build great ideas and products on top of that. So it could be like a one-man operation, a two-man operation. It could be 50 to, 500 people, whatever. We're here for all of those people.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on the Newstalk app, in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Fardy's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.